Recordings have started.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, it's Greg Chapman.
Good morning, Greg.
Hey, Greg, it sounds like you've got Holly. You've also got Sharon Flanagan.
Hi, Sharon.
Josh Hoffheimer's on, too. Is there something wrong with the Adobe Connect audio? I see Jonathan and Martin both commenting on that. Oh, it's now turned on. Okay. I tend to dial in personally because I like to be able to stand up and walk away from the computer microphone.
Hi, it's Jonathan. I'm on the audio now.
Great.
And apologies that I'm not on Adobe and have called in instead. I'm in a car. I have physical therapy for shoulder surgery every Wednesday morning early, so I'm in transit.
Well, I appreciate you letting us share your morning commute from to or from physical therapy.
Mm-hmm. Are we expecting other people? Or are we ready?
I think we're ready. I think Lisa is still traveling.
Yeah, we've just got to let Martin come in because he wasn't able to get in previously on the. He's in now, so Martin's joined us. Greg, Holly, I'm conscious we haven't set out an agenda. We've sort of, I know that this was described as an initial diligence call, so I'm a little, and we wanted to get something going sooner rather than later. I'm a little in the dark as to the structure or how we organize this, but maybe so it's a question of really how we're going to organize the call. I'm not sure if either of you have had any thoughts on that, but let's...
I'll expect the one conducting diligence has. So.
If I could make a proposal, your scoping document lays out, your thinking on some proposals, and we thought that maybe that would provide a guide for us to ask some questions about how you came to these proposals. I'm going to ask that either Ed or Josh or Sharon sort of take the lead, because you may get a lot of background noise, and I'd like to pretty much put this on mute and listen in. But that was our thought, that we have some questions on that document, and we were driven by that document. And if that's an okay agenda, I suggest we move forward.
Yeah, that works. But so we really need to probably give you the genesis of that document and that thinking, and then take a Q&A from you on the back of that, I suppose.
I think we certainly would be helpful to understand the genesis of the not so much of the document itself, but the proposals within the document and the questions in the document. And you can lead off, or we can jump right in with questions. But why don't you take the lead?
Greg, would you like to give a stab at that, or would you like me to? I mean, it really, I think we go back to just pre-Frankfurt, the proposal on the contract co, the response from the group to that, and then ultimately moving forward to an attempt to provide some form of integrated solution. You
I
may
think
be
that's right.
more familiar with the detail. Would you like to sketch that out quickly?
Sure, absolutely. I think the place to start really is, as we looked at what our overall assignment was, in essence, was to analyze and to replace, except where we thought otherwise, the current oversight and stewardship of the NTIA, and to generally ensure that the IANA functions were going forward would be operated with an eye toward operational excellence. And I think that we circled the question a number of different ways, but ultimately we looked at what we would call kind of a functional analysis of the overall role of the NTIA, and what were each of the kind of tasks or roles that it played with regard to its relationship to the IANA functions, operations within ICANN, and the workflow and overall, as I said, the role. So we then tried to think about how to replace those roles. And really what developed in Frankfurt, in our face-to-face meeting there, was the first proposal, the one that we call contract, the contract co or external, first external proposal. I think the idea there was that, you know, each of the aspects or each of the groups that or entities that were created in that process matched up to or performed one or more of the NTIA functions.
So Greg, can you talk about this, Sharon? So it looks like on the external solution, there's two alternatives to that. There's a contract co, or I might sometimes call it new co, and then there's a trust model.
Yeah.
So how did you arrive at those as your approaches?
First, it should be stated that those were arrived at very different times in the process. When we came out of Frankfurt, we had only the NUCO solution on the external side, and really only conceptual internal solution. Neither of the proposals that are there as the internal solution were per se sketched out in Frankfurt. We actually left Frankfurt really with what felt like a fairly strong affinity for the NUCO solution, but with a reasonably
substantial group of participants who disfavored the external solution and who were independently seeking to develop an internal solution. So that's kind of where we were. And if you were to go and look at the, I guess we should put this on our list, the draft report that was circulated to the entire community, to all the stakeholder groups, and anybody else who wanted to comment on the draft report. The draft report really set out only the NUCO solution. It stated that there was an internal solution was also being discussed, and looked for some general comments on how an internal solution might work and what would be better about that than an external solution.
Can you explain sort of what that constituency was that who that was comprised of that was objecting to the external NUCO solution and was positing an internal or a trust solution?
Sure. I would say that the internalists at the time of Frankfurt largely consisted of a group out of the ALAC, the At-Large Advisory Committee, which is set up to represent the interests of the end user in ICANN. There were others who also were uncomfortable with an external solution. Notably, it became clear that ICANN, at least some members of the ICANN board and others were also opposed to an external solution.
What was the reasons they gave you?
Well, it has to go back to all the public comments. We have copious documentation. I think main reasons were that the external solution was too complex. It created too many structures that themselves were ill-defined, that could be prone to capture, that they didn't trust the division of powers among these different entities, that this wouldn't be acceptable to the U.S. government, that it wouldn't be acceptable to ICANN, and that I think those were, that's kind of a very, some of the top line ones, and obviously, Jonathan Martin can jump in on their view.
Let me come in there for a moment. I think one of the overarching parameters is stability, both now and in the future. So a stable transition and a stable ongoing function that isn't prone to disruption, whether that's by capture or some other mechanism. So I think some argued that an external solution may be in some way less stable. I'm sure I'll get brickbats for suggesting that, because others would say any form of separability is unstable. There was a sense that ICANN, there was one argument put forward that ICANN was the natural, in quotes, home for the IANA function, and therefore our job was not so much to find alternative homes or potential homes in an eventual scenario for the IANA function, but rather to find remedies via the accountability group should ICANN and or IANA not perform in a satisfactorily accountable fashion. And so when the point argument is made about complexity, one of the elements of that argument was that by building in separability, and in particular probably with an external approach, we were potentially building, in quotes, another ICANN, creating another whole structure. Whereas, and so those sort of arguments led back to saying, well, why don't you consider working within the ICANN structures and then having separability as an ultimate endpoint if absolutely necessary, but why set that up from the outset? Rick, can you remind me what the term is? There's a second term. I mean, we currently have functional separation. separation. In other words, IANA is functionally separate within the ICANN operation. What's a structural separation?
Structural separation.
So concept is of structural. Exactly. And I think those were the sort of main additions or supplements I wanted to make.
Yeah, I think a variation on the theme of what Jonathan said was that some people said that the structure, that the external solution, the NewCo solution, was set up primarily to ensure separability, and that was inappropriate, that to set that up as the primary reason for the structure, that the structure, and that any solution should be set up primarily to deal with day-to-day operations and oversight of the IANA functions and IANA functions group, and not to kind of elevate separability as the prime directive.
So, this is Holly. May I ask a question? I just want to make sure I understand the concept of capture, the worry about capture. Is it that you're worried that an entity could be overtaken by one particular group of stakeholders?
The word capture is used a lot and yet not particularly well-defined, or I should say that there are a variety of definitions. That is certainly one of the definitions. Another definition is that a group could be taken over by a number of stakeholder groups outsized to their actual kind of proportion, or that a group could be held hostage by one group, keeping it from moving forward, or that capture could be one country or a group of countries taking over, and that this, you know, could include capture by way of influencing or secretly putting people on boards or in positions of influence, or people having conflicts of influence, interests, especially unrevealed conflicts of interest. It's one of the, I wouldn't say it's a bogeyman, because there are legitimate concerns about capture, but it's, it gets thrown around a fair amount, and it's definitely, while it can't be ignored, it could also, it's important to try to dig down and do exactly what you do, which is say, what concerns are you actually expressing when you talk about capture?
Suppose, Greg and colleagues, one way of looking at this is to say there are a set of functions, technical, operational functions, that IANA performs on appropriate instruction. In addition, there are a set of oversight functions, that overarching functions that NTIA performs, which are, for all practical purposes, limited, but ultimately,
excuse
potentially...
Ms. Gregory joins.
Okay, just to recapture that, so that there are a set of technical functions that IANA performs, and under appropriate instruction executes those, and ideally to the appropriate performance levels. Then over and above all of that is NTIA's role, which is, to all intents and purposes on a daily basis, very hands-off, but is nominally a very powerful role, in the sense that it could nominally seek to offer the IANA function to another contracting entity. The NTIA could, in theory, although it has never, by all accounts, come close to doing so, not authorize the change to the route. And so there are these overarching functions that, should they be replaced by, then in this example, a captured entity, it could exert significant power over, potentially over, changes to the route. So one looks at those two levels, I suppose, that might illustrate forms of capture. But capture could, in theory, I guess, occur at the oversight of the technical function, let alone the overarching oversight.
Can we talk a little bit about, before we get into the two examples of external and the two examples of internal, can we talk about two of the committees or groups that seem to be common points between the models, the first being the MRT and the second being the CSC? It sounds like the CSC would have more day-to-day responsibility, and the MRT is where the CSC escalates to, and then the MRT, one of its chief functions would be to cause the separation or at least cause the review. But could you talk a little bit more about who the stakeholders would be in each of those and how you envision responsibilities being divided up?
Sure, I can take a first crack at that, and then Jonathan Martin can jump in. I mean, let's start with the CSC, and I think your characterizations of the two groups really are correct, although the overall structure, you know, is still something that's, under discussion, and not every potential solution may have those, but to the extent they are common to the solutions, you know, that is the idea. Furthermore, the idea is that the CSC would be primarily composed of representatives of the what we've been calling the direct customers of the IANA functions operations, which are the registries, the GTLD and CCTLD registries. There's been a lot of composition overall has been one of the hot button areas of discussion on any of these groups as groups jockey for position and worry about others jockeying for position and worry about capture, and some worry about antitrust issues as well. Some among the registries would like the CSC to be a registries-only committee or to be registries plus, in essence, kind of operational and technical experts who are familiar with and can contribute to refined expert judgments on the operations of the of the CSC. Others would like the group to have some or more multi-stakeholder representation, including stakeholders from the, I'll call them the non-operational side of the community, those that don't interact directly with the IANA function. So the CSC would take the place of day-to-day oversight. It would be the group that would receive whatever reports the NTIA, or rather the IANA function operation, put out. The current IANA contract specifies a number of periodic, you know, both monthly and annual types of operations reports, and especially service level type reports. Those would all go to the CSC. And as you say, the MRT would be kind of the second level. If the CSC weren't able to resolve issues that it identified through their oversight, then they would escalate that to the MRT, which would continue to try to resolve those issues and possibly ultimately move up to various solutions ending at least potentially in separability, or in separation, I should say, not separability. The MRT, so let me stop there before we go to the MRT and see what Jonathan and Martin might want to say about the CSC.
It's Jonathan. I'll just make the comment, then I'll pause and make sure we give you guys a chance to ask further questions. But in very simplistic terms, if IANA is a supplier and the registries or users of that service are the customers, the CSC has a role akin to a manager within that customer. It's a senior role that makes sure that the customer's getting what the customer wants. Now, as Greg says, we can debate whether or not the customer should have representatives from other areas. But in essence, the CSC is responsible for oversight of the performance and making sure that happens. So I think of that as a manager or executive at the customer. Then there is, in addition to that, a requirement for periodic oversight of the whole thing, And should the customer not get what the customer wants to get, a form of escalation. And that's where we get the MRT. I think of the MRT in my own analogy, just to help me understand it, as something like a board, a form of oversight of that. And it's possible that in some thinking, members of the CSC would also have a position on the MRT, analogous to executives and non-executives on a board. So that's my simplistic analogy of the services performed and who gets to receive them and how that hangs together, and to some extent why that is independent of the models, because those functions, if you like, a form of direct customer representation and oversight and escalation are required independent of the model. Thanks.
Okay, John, can I add something? It's Maarten.
Please.
I do agree with your simple model, but one thing I don't think that has been decided yet is who will set from the side of the CSC and MRT, who will set the SLA? I've heard many discussions on it, and I'm not sure. I would say it will be the CSC, but I'm a registry, so that's. But I think there are a number of people who still think that it should be part of the MRT. So it's still vague in things.
Right, and I think Martin's comment. This is Greg again. You know, highlights the importance of the service level. That are at the heart of this is, you know, what is the performance? What defines operational excellence, or at least operational acceptability for the performance of the IANA functions? You'll find that people throw, the people use terms a little bit that sometimes don't exactly mean the same thing. So when I hear SLA, I think service level agreement, which is more than just setting service levels, but is a larger agreement. That contains other aspects of a contract about service level. But in any case, I think there's probably a middle view, too, which is that the CSC would set service levels, but with the oversight of the MRT, in part due to concerns about capture, if you will, or that the having the customers alone setting the service levels could potentially result in some sort of mismatch or control without proper oversight. I think it should also be said that our general mandate that's set out in the request for proposals that came from the coordinating group for all the IANA proposals, the ICG, essentially says that we should not change anything without justifying why we're changing it. So there are existing service levels, as you would expect, under which the IANA functions operations perform. So those would likely start out, or should, in my opinion, start out as the baseline for any future discussion of service level. And not to skip massively out of order, but under the current work plan of the CWG, started spawning small groups, which we're calling design teams, which is a design to take specific aspects of a proposal to come up with a kind of working design or draft of those to bring back to the CWG as a whole for review and debate, and ultimately to be dropped into the next version of the proposal response to the request for proposal. There is a design team set up for service levels.
And, Greg, another question about the CSC, and it'll apply to the MRT too, but how has there been any discussion yet on how membership would be determined, how you would decide who would serve on those two committees?
Yeah, there's been plenty of discussion. obviously no resolution. I think that typically in both cases, there's kind of two levels. First, there's determining what the seats are, so to speak, what the composition is itself. And that's to be decided, I think, under almost any version of this by the CWG itself, setting up the initial organization. And then who would fill those seats on behalf of a particular entity would be done within the entity. So, for instance, you know, if there is a seat that is for GTLD registries, that the GTLD registries, who are largely but not completely members of the registry stakeholder group, would decide who fills those seats. And there would also be certain parameters in terms of defining, you know, what the role and nature of filling that seat is, in terms of representation versus kind of a more of a public good type of definition. But generally speaking, you know, with a belief that there is representatives of the larger community or stakeholder group that they're there to represent.
Greg, this is Holly. May I ask a question going back to your discussion of the CWG's efforts with respect to service levels? As I read, and I don't have a full copy of the CWG charter in front of me, and we should certainly take a look at it, but is that considered a core component of the transition proposal, or is it sort of secondary or even tertiary to the structure of the proposal?
I would say, and I'll again, you know, let everyone else jump in, that it's a primary. That, again, you know, we have kind of a number of aspects of this, and one aspect of our group is to set up a structure that ensures ongoing operational excellence, and that service levels are at the heart of operational excellence, or at least the ability to oversee an operation to determine if definitions of excellence, what those definitions are and how they're being met. So I think any proposal we have has to both, kind of taking it from the highest level down, has to demonstrate how service levels would be reported on, monitored, what those service levels would be, and who is overseeing those service levels.
I think it's Martin. I think I have a different opinion on that. I think that the service levels themselves are secondary. There are service levels, and in general, everyone is quite happy with the way IANA performs currently. So you could say, simplify things, let's keep the service levels we have and use them again. But then one thing is quite, what is important, and that's not secondary, that's primary, is that we need to have a mechanism afterwards to change the SLAs where necessary. And so it will be a mechanism towards IANA to tell them we would like to change the SLA this way, but also a mechanism to decide what we want to change and how do we come to a decision on this. So that's primary, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, I wouldn't mind adding something here as well, but let me wait and see if there's a follow-up question and I'll come in.
Now, go ahead, Jonathan. I'd like to ask a few questions after you about ICANN itself.
Okay, let me try and come in with a slightly different sort of view of it. I don't think it contradicts what's been said, but just the question was that kicked us off here is what's the function of the chart? And in clear terms, and you may have all of this clear, but the ICG asks the three different communities for proposals. we're producing our proposal. In producing our proposal, the way in which we work, the very first thing we do is when setting out on this kind of work stream, is to say, well, what's the scope of work? And the charter defines the scope of work. So the charter is our bedrock for setting out what we'll do in response to the ICG. Prior to Frankfurt, the modus operandi was to say, right, here's this existing contract. Let's dissect this and pull this apart and look at all of what it contains. We did a comprehensive job of pulling it apart and undertaking to analyze that whole contract. And at the same time, we became strongly focused on what the method of achieving structural separation might be. That left us with a very detailed analysis of the contract and some various models, of which you've now seen their evolution as to how to achieve the functional separation. But it didn't leave us, in a sense, any closer to a proposal. So in one way, what we were doing was a kind of bottom-up approach. And the group became more and more and more focused on the model for functional for structural separation. And we became clearer and clearer that what we really needed was some help in understanding what models were possible to achieve structural separation and what the risks and issues associated with those. Now, some of those are clearly political risks. Most simplistically, would the NTIA accept a proposal that had structural separation with a contract co in it? But some of them are clearly what's possible and what are the risks associated with it legally. And in many ways, that seems to me to be the question we're asking you. The criticism we faced as we went into the Singapore meeting was, you guys are obsessed with structural separation or mechanics of separation, and you're not doing the real job, which is really building out a proposal that responds directly to the RFP from the ICG and deals with all of the technical issues that are associated with it. And so in response to that, I think what we did was made a slightly different approach, which is what Greg's referred to and others, and we said, right, we'll build out a series of design teams that deal with the detailed responses to that RFP, and that's what the design teams are attempting to do. Those all lock into an overarching draft proposal that we're working on, but none of that deals satisfactorily with the critical question of, in the event that we finally require a form of structural separation, how would we achieve that? And knowing how we would achieve that, how would that back into the proposal? So for me, that's how I see a critical question being asked. And Martin's right to highlight that throughout all of this, no one is saying that in very broad terms, the IANA function is performing unsatisfactorily at the moment, or the SLAs are not being broadly and satisfactorily met. But what the challenge is to make sure they continue to be, and in the event of their repeated failure to be met and or fail to evolve satisfactorily as appropriate over time, that we have the appropriate recourse. So I hope that kind of captures it and puts the charter in the right place to try and answer Holly's question.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Good. Feel free to ask follow-up questions of us now on the back of that or Greg or Martin's prior input.
Thank you. This is Josh Hoffheimer again. I mean, building on what you just said, it's clear that sort of operationally, ICANN, seems to have support, but there and is performing well. But there were, several comments in the scoping document about some discomfort sort of at the policy level with how things are being, there's a comment to disagreement with ICANN's board's interpretation and implementation of policies developed through the multi-stakeholder policy development process. So can you maybe give us a little bit of color on, how well the current sort of board structure for controlling ICANN with the multi-stakeholders, how well that appears to be functioning, and also if you could explain whether there is this sort of outside policy development aspect that takes place outside of the ICANN entity or the administration that has created some friction with ICANN itself and that we have to try to solve for through this process.
Well, this is Greg. I guess
first,
Jonathan, did you want to go ahead?
Greg, I wouldn't mind, and then see if where you fit into. It'll be interesting to see how we interpret this. But from my point of view, at a very simplistic level, what we've come to recognize is that arguably this isn't within the remit of the group. There are some concerns with the way in which the board oversees the policy function within ICANN, and an example of such a concern might be that there is no recourse to appeal a decision of the board on the basis of its merits, only on the basis of whether such policy such procedures were followed. But what's interesting about all of that is that's arguably outside of the remit of this group, in that this group is supposed to deal with the stewardship of the IANA function. However, that having said that, because of the overarching role of the NTIA and the fact that the NTIA has this oversight of the whole and could in theory, for example, contract the IANA function to another entity, there is a direct link between this work and the work of the accountability group, whereas arguably where this sort of discussion should take place. So the critical thing to do is to make sure that that this group does its work on the transition and the dealing with the transition and make sure it has the appropriate links into the work of the accountability group. So I'm afraid in with this group's issues, one has to have some grasp of what goes on in the accountability area. I'm not sure I've answered that as quite as crisply as I like, but I'll rather than dig deeper into trying to explain it, let's see if Greg's got a similar or slightly different take.
Thank you, Jonathan. I agree with everything you said. I was actually going to answer the question from a different angle, which was first to say that ICANN, the term ICANN, can mean at least three different things, depending upon how you look at it. Often it has to be qualified, and more people are kind of fluent in talking about ICANN, the less that they explicitly qualify what they're talking about. In this context, at least, ICANN can mean ICANN as the IANA functions operator, which really refers to just the activities that take place within the IANA functions group, which is about 12 people or so who are in charge of taking in various instructions about setting up the root zone and other related technical functions of the Internet working with those instructions and ultimately passing them on to be for those changes to be placed in the root by the root zone maintainer. So that's one ICANN. When you hear when people say they're not unhappy with or that ICANN performance as the IANA functions operator is satisfactory and that nobody wants to change it right now, virtually nobody, that's the ICANN they're referring to. It's really those 12 people, give or take. Then there is ICANN, the corporation, which is this, 300-odd people who are employed by ICANN and also including its board. And I generally refer to that if I need to as ICANN, the corporation. And then third, there's ICANN, the community, which is, other than Sam, who's on the line, and staff support, all of us are part of ICANN, the community, but not ICANN, the corporation. So it's kind of, when you say that ICANN is performing well, but that there are concerns about policy, that really goes to kind of the tension between ICANN, the functions operator, the IANA functions operator, and ICANN, the corporation. And those tensions are kind of being identified by ICANN, the community. So we have ICANN talking about the differences between ICANN and ICANN, just to make it sound as difficult to understand as possible. That said, and going back to the whole concept of separation, when Jonathan talks about or highlights the issue of functional versus structural separation, that's really separating the IANA functions operations within ICANN, which are operational, from the policy making policy oversight, policy implementation functions of the rest of ICANN, which is what takes place outside the IANA functions operation, and which by the IANA contract are required to be separate, so that the IANA doesn't become kind of a policy football, so to speak.
That's helpful. Thanks. Can we get a little bit granular for a moment? Although it won't be too granular, but focusing on the key elements that CWG identified, and so that we can, because you just highlighted a very good point when you were talking about separation and separation at the policy level versus the functional level. And I've heard the term used just several times in this conversation, and it feels to me like there's different intent behind it. So I think it would be helpful to us to understand in a little more detail the meaning and sort of the intent behind the five key elements that you all identified that need to be addressed in the proposals for transition. So I don't know if people have a copy of that document that has that in it. But if we could go through that, I think that would be helpful, and then and we could simply team people can ask some questions. But just as the first one says, maintaining separability, the ability to replace ICANN as the IANA functions operator in the event of significant performance failures through the potential of RFPs. So give a little bit more clarity on that, because that does sound like a different type of separability than you were just describing between regarding roles and responsibilities.
Right. Now, I think when we talk about separability, it is the ability to separate the IANA functions, either the IANA functions operator from the rest of IANA, and literally to put it under in a different home, or the ability to take away the ability to perform the IANA function from ICANN and to give that contract, so to speak, to another group that would assemble a team of people and the necessary technical requirements to perform the IANA functions operation instead of the current IANA group within ICANN. So it means both of those things. I think primarily when we use it, I think we tend to mean essentially giving the contract to another entity that would perform the IANA functions operations and staff up and equip itself however it sees fit.
Greg, I'd like to come in here and just highlight one a point. Correct. Functional separation exists today. The IANA function, the IANA functions operator, is housed in a discrete part of the building with discrete staff and is, to that extent, functionally separate from the rest of the IANA corporation. In general, no one is challenging or seeking to alter that, both currently and or in the near future. The structural separation whereby that function could be, if necessary, removed by virtue of physically and or contractually is clearly what the discussion is. And if so, how so? What are the legal and corporate mechanics that might be available to us to be able to achieve that, either to be in a state of readiness to achieve that should it be required, or to execute that at some future date and have done the appropriate preparatory work to do so. I think there's one other thing to highlight, and that on the back of having written the charter for this group, one of the first working documents that the group prepared was the principles on which it would work. And as things stand, the principles have not yet been formally signed off, although they are very close to being so. And enshrined in those principles is the concept of separability, which in my understanding refers to structural separability. In other words, that at minimum, that such structural separability should be achievable if necessary after a series of ultimate steps has taken place. So that's sort of my take on separability as it stands at the moment.
So one follow-up question to that, and it helps me to understand. So I appreciate, I hear what you're saying, and it sounds like, you know, at the, if I can repeat back, at the functional level, things today are working pretty well. There's a separate group within ICANN that is maintaining or performing the functions around the IANA functions operator and the contract that's been let to ICANN. And on a go-forward basis, there's a desire to establish or maintain some mechanisms that would enable that to be, would enable separateness between the structure of the kind of non-functionally focused parts of ICANN and the IANA functions operator parts of ICANN, and keep that separate. Or even, you know, in a more egregious scenario, split it off and let the functions operator role and responsibility to a third party. But let me ask you, just under today, you know, just today, if we were going to continue, if we continued with the current relationship and NTIA, you know, was granting the functions, the IANA functions operator contract, awarding that to ICANN on an annual basis, what would happen if, say, in 2016, NTIA awarded the functions contract to a different entity, to an entirely separate third party? What happens to ICANN at that point? What role does it have? And does it cease to exist, or does it continue? And does it have some responsibility that would continue if it is no longer the IANA functions operator?
Okay, I will make a quick stab at answering that and see if anyone else has. ICANN's other functions are various, but in the context of this, I guess it is primarily in and around the oversight and development of policy in and around domain names. So ICANN would, at minimum, continue to have that function. Now, you might argue, and some do argue, that the legitimacy that ICANN has to undertake that policy-making function is inextricably linked to its operation of the IANA function. In other words, it's ICANN's management of these two functions is one and the same thing. Clearly, the proponents of structural separation at least consider that these two could be operated separately, but there is a school of thought that says they cannot, and in fact should not, that ICANN was fundamentally set up to do both in the first place. So there is some discussion around that, and there isn't a single answer, but I hope that in an attempt to give you a brief answer, that gives a picture of what's going on.
This is Greg, yeah. If I could jump in. First, I agree 100% with what Jonathan has said, and also that certainly there are those who would argue it on a policy level or a kind of theoretical level, and also use the argument that ICANN exists only because it performs AANA function, in spite of the fact that a large majority of what it does is not operate the AANA function. And they'll use that to support arguments of that there should not be separability, in essence, and that ICANN was purpose-built for the function of taking on the IANA functions. And others would say, well, that may be true, 15 years, 17 years ago, but look at it now. You've got 300, plus employees, and 12 of them are doing IANA. Clearly, that's not what it is. I think it's on a practical level that would obviously have to be solved for. In any move of the IANA functions contract away from ICANN to a third party, and that the idea of reconstructing ICANN from scratch and letting all of the current operations go would be science fiction, and that any new structuring would have to essentially keep the rest of ICANN in business, doing all the other things that ICANN does. In spite of whatever the theories are about why it exists or what the basis is, that in a practical world that would have to be resolved. I want to go back to the playback of separability with two points. First, when people talk about separability, they're not really talking about the intermediate step of, oh, things are going really bad, so now we're going to put the IANA functions into its own subsidiary or further structurally separate it from ICANN, but leave ICANN kind of in charge, that itself would satisfy separation. As a result of performance failures. I think when people are talking about the need for separation, it's to take it, the IANA function, away from ICANN completely. So, while we haven't worked out all the escalations and kind of penalties, if you will, and conceivably, in working those out, a penalty of moving from functional to structural separation, could be worked into the mix. That doesn't seem to be top of mind. Secondly, I would say that, or should mention that, there have been discussions throughout and recently, or fairly recently, revived of structurally separating the IANA functions from the rest of ICANN as a part of the transition. In other words, have an IANA sub as a wholly owned or partially owned entity of ICANN, but for it to be structurally separated, as in being in its own subsidiary corporation with its own discrete budget, with its own board, its own kind of service providers or a services agreement with ICANN for things such as HR and the like, and that would be kind of the post-transition result would be a structural separation, which in turn would make separability and some great a total separation more readily achievable at a later date.
Right. Okay. Thank you. That's helpful too. I was going to move on to the second point, and Greg, thank you for sharing the five
things, but I wanted to pause for a moment to see if anybody on the Sibley side had a follow-up question on number one. Okay. So then you talk about, you know, continuing to have binding documentation of ICANN duties and obligations as the, you know, that's currently set forth in the IANA functions contract with NTIA. So I guess one question I had, if you absorbed and you made, you know, in the context of the internal solution, you made IANA ICANN a semi-permanent repository for the IANA functions operations. How is it that, what are people envisioning that they would do to maintain that binding documentation or that standard? Because it seems to me that number two, if you take that to its logical conclusion, it does require two separate entities, one to hold the rights and be able to enforce it against the other.
This is Greg. I'll take a first crack at that, and then I think others can and will jump in. First, I would say that ICANN is already the semi-permanent, if not permanent, home of the IANA functions at the operational basis. It's that oversight side that is currently not really the home of, although obviously it is the home of it at a intermediate level, since the IANA functions group, you know, doesn't operate within impunity or, you know, utter complete, you know, independence within ICANN. I would ask others to talk to kind of what kind of oversight ICANN currently performs over the IANA functions operation, but I don't believe that they operate as kind of a commando force, utterly beholden to no one other than the NTIA. So it's really, the question is, once you remove the NTIA as that outside oversight function and kind of the holder of the other end of the IANA functions contract, how do you replace it in an internal world, so to speak? And I suppose the ideas that have been floated there is that it would be that there would be kind of internal documentation within the organization that was ratified, or maybe that's the wrong word, but kind of approved by the overseers of the IANA function, that while it wouldn't be a contract per se, because there wouldn't be another party holding it, that it would be kind of the same as in any other organization, that departments have performance expectations that they owe to their managers, and the managers owe to their managers up to the top, and that those are, or should be, clearly set out and reviewed on a periodic basis and approved, and that if there is failure you know, in a typical organization, you know, that would those would be set out, and the managers and the managers' managers would, in terms of failure, try to resolve those issues, fire people, heads will roll, and all sorts of things like that. I think the idea is that, you know, documentation here could be some sort of similar internal documentation that would be approved, perhaps even up to the board of ICANN, but that critically it would also need to be approved by the CSC and MRT, or whatever combination of those two, and that the oversight of those groups, however they would be structured in an internal solution, would also be a key part of monitoring and enforcing satisfaction of those service expectations. And part of that, of course, is, you know, if we're looking to you guys. I just finished up. You know, one of the things we're looking to. Go ahead, John.
Unfortunately, there's a bit of a lag, so sorry, one responds, and then you hear it's... I guess that I was just going to point, Greg, and I'll pause for you to finish off if you needed to afterwards, that the issue is of clearly of repeated escalation, failure to perform, and then ultimate recourse. And one of the things that's been represented to us indirectly, or at least discussed, is that in a corporation such as ICANN is, that it's not possible to have a mechanism, or potentially not possible to have a mechanism of recourse, in other words, under repeated failure and escalation and so on, in the ultimate scenario, that is not subservient to the board. So the concern, I think I could accurately represent, would be the IANA function repeatedly fails to perform. We go through a series of documented escalation mechanisms. No remedies are satisfactory. Repeated failure to perform occurs, and an escalation and the ultimate recourse is exercised. However, that ultimate recourse doesn't exist because the board either could overrule it, or it would be constitutionally impossible to have such a solution because the board is the ultimate authority. So that's one of the apparent concerns with respect to a so-called internal solution. And as I understand, I've explained it very much in layman's terms, but one of the legal challenges, if you like. Thanks. Sorry to have cut across you earlier, Greg.
That's a very good response, Jonathan, and clarified one thing for me, which kind of ties into the third point. And so let me ask the question. You know, you just described the failure being focused on a failure at the IANA function level that might necessitate a need to change the functions, the IANA functions operator. But you're not talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're not talking about if there were, for example, a disagreement at the policymaking level of ICANN, or there were, you know, a rogue sort of group that wanted to make a significant change in policy or had significant disagreements with the policies that were being promulgated by ICANN, that could somehow, but the IANA functions operator implementing whatever policies ultimately were approved by the ICANN board, you know, to administer or to implement functions. If the ICANN functions, the IANA functions operator is continuing to do its job effectively, we're not talking about a means to remove, or people aren't looking for a means to remove ICANN as the functions operator because of a disagreement at the policy level of ICANN.
That's a very astute question, and it hits at a heart of the point. And my understanding is, within the remit of this group, what you've just said is absolutely correct. However, the subtlety is that with the withdrawal of the ultimate oversight of the NTIA, the community at large would like to be assured that if there is some form of failure to perform at the policy level, there is the appropriate recourse to do so. However, that problem, that issue, is being dealt with in the accountability track. So it is being dealt with separately, but it is connected to the withdrawal of the NTIA, which is why these paths of work are often described as parallel, interdependent, linked, and so on. So strictly, it's not within our remit, but there is a connection, and I think you've hit it fairly closely on the head, it feels to me, and I've got the grasp of it in the way you described it there.
That's a difficult issue, then.
This is Greg, if I could just add. I think that, you know, one of the things that has been discussed is, you know, along those lines, is how unlikely it would be one of these scenarios versus the other, and, you know, which ICANN, if you will, is the one that failure would require separation, a failure at the IANA level or a failure at the enterprise level. So I think, in essence, both are on the table. Some, you know, believe that, you know, one or the other scenario is kind of beyond, is more or less likely than the other.
Maybe to add something to the confusion, or although I think a number of things have become quite clear, is that there are some that say if the accountability work stream is successful and comes up with a solution where the community, whatever that means, will get the last say in ICANN, which many feel that they don't have now, separability is not necessary.
Martin, if I may, I think that's a really good point, and it links to AA. I won't try and repeat what you said. I think you expressed it well, but there's a related point, I suppose, and that's just to make sure that the Sidley group know that in terms of and interrelated nature of the work, one of the there is a work stream within, there's two work streams within the accountability group, and the work stream must necessarily be complete or sufficiently strongly committed to being complete for our proposal to fly. In other words, we envisage our proposal being conditional on work stream one of the accountability work being complete or sufficiently strongly committed to for our proposal to work. So we will make our proposal conditional on the satisfactory completion or perception of the ability to complete work stream one to work. And then you get to the point that Martin made. Well, it may be that work stream one has got sufficient belts and braces in it that some may feel that separability is no longer an issue. So that's I think that's a really important point to have brought in.
But what you're saying, when you say that it's conditioned, it's not just that it be completed, but that the accountability work stream recommendations that come through will be, you know, consistent with and able to be realized by the recommended structure from this work stream. Correct? So there may still be an adjustment or changes, if you will, in structure that would be designed to accommodate and sort of achieve the recommendations of the accountability work stream. Is that correct in my understanding?
Let me try and answer that indirectly, and if it's not a satisfactory or satisfactorily clear answer, others can step in or the question can be asked again. We'll make our proposal for the transition, and we will say our proposal is conditional on satisfactory completion of work stream one in the accountability work. That doesn't assume that our proposal relies on separability or not. That's a distinct question as to whether we it's the internal or external model or whatever the case is. But our proposal is very likely to be specified as being conditional on certain key accountability measures being in place and committed to that have been developed in Workstream 1. So our objective would be to be satisfied that all of what we require or much of what we require, all of what's necessary is dealt with in accountability track 1.
I think if I may, the question that Workstream 1 is trying to answer is the question, what accountability measures are necessary within the current ICANN structure or the transition. So that's the difficulty. They look from a different perspective to it. And one of the things I'm personally bothered with is if they are going to solve things that we see as a problem. But, okay, it's very interdependent.
Okay.
All right. You know, given where we are with time, at this point, I think rather than to continue through the remaining four and five of the five key elements, which I think we've touched on many of these points already, unless somebody on Sidley has a specific question about some of the language in number four or five, I would suggest, I think we want to move into being able to ask some questions and answers and getting a little bit into the two external solutions, the description of the two external solutions and the internal solution.
Josh, this is Ed. I did want to jump in for a second with a question. In terms of, we talk about the potential for failure of ICANN to perform one of the functions. Given VeriSign's role in terms of operating many of these functions, what is there a particular example that people have in their mind of what sort of failure to perform we're thinking about? Just as to kind of make it a crisp example, could that be very helpful for me for my thinking actually to give it. Particular example of that, if there's one that leaps to mind.
I think that's a really good question. It's been in my mind as we've talked that practical examples might bring things home along the way. I think two examples I would spring to mind, and I think bringing VeriSign in as root zone maintainer probably confuses things at the moment. So I would leave VeriSign. VeriSign has a unique and distinct role and a specific contract to perform specific functions that are different from the functions that IANA performs. So I would just put that aside for the moment. But in terms of two examples, I would say the IANA failing to perform might be either putting a requesting that a TLD and ensuring that a TLD goes into the root when that wasn't requested, or alternatively, refusing to put one in when that was appropriately requested. Those would be, in my mind, failure to perform. Now, there would be variations along the right way, such as doing that too slowly outside of the SLAs, but the ultimate failure to perform, an example of which would be those two. That's very different to that's the accountability to perform the IANA function as required, and that's quite different to ICANN itself. ICANN, on a policy-making basis, not being accountable or not being sufficiently accountable according to the community's requirements. It's a specific example of a failure to perform the IANA function as required.
This is Greg. If I could just add one thing to Jonathan, I think that, you know, a single failure or a small number of failures to perform quickly probably would not be a let's call it a material breach for kind of legal term, but that a systemic and uncured failure to perform up to service level, you know, probably would be a trigger for some sort of, large change in relationship or the like. And just to come back to, I know Jonathan laid aside VeriSign's role, but just to pick it up for a moment, I think VeriSign's role should kind of be seen as, if you look at this as a workflow, work
orders, if you will, in a generic way, start on the name side largely with the PLD operator, or initially with the board approving a PLD being delegated into the root. And then those, the work, if there are other less, exciting or substantial things that changes that are made, you know, updating the records of an existing PLD, for instance, within the root, which, you know, can be viewed as kind of a who is records for first-level domains or top-level domains instead of second-level. So those kind of changes also come through the function. So there's a workflow, and then the workflow is out through the authorization function, a validation function that's currently done by the NTIA, and then on to the root zone maintainer for the change to actually be functionally made to the root itself. So we're not looking at the VeriSign side of things here. We're looking at the Diana portion of that workflow. So just to kind of bring a fine point on kind of which box in the workflow we're focusing on. We're focusing on that, and we're focusing on the NCIA box, which is going away and being replaced in some fashion, or decisions being made not to replace certain aspects of the contract. Thank you.
Okay, great. So can we turn now to the structures that you're considering? It looks like there's four structures on the table. There's on the external side, there's the contract co or a trust, and then on the internal side, there's a golden bylaw, let's call it, and then a trust. So, and it looks like a lot of thought's been already given to these structures, and so it would be helpful for us to understand a little bit about how you got to each of these and maybe walk through them. It sounds like the goals are all the same. It's just these are different vehicles to achieve those goals, and part of our mandate is to help you understand what the pros and cons are of the different structures. But maybe we can start with external and start with the contract co, and you can just tell us what the thoughts are there. Is the idea that this is to look like ICANN in terms of California nonprofit? Has that structure generally worked historically, just from a pure corporate law standpoint?
So I'm going to defer to Greg, but I just wouldn't mind making one quick comment before. I think that's an accurate assessment to the extent that it was of the task and the question asked as well. There is, subsequent to the preparation of this, there has been put on the table an attempt to create some form of hybrid solution. So you should be aware that there is a variant that is being worked on that attempts to integrate or and I think it's and produce some form of integrated proposal, but in that doesn't make the question any less valid or your understanding of the scope. But just to make sure that you're aware that that's bubbling away in the background as well. Great.
Okay.
Over
yeah,
to you.
That's helpful. So yeah, you could combine. You could have a contract co, and maybe the contract co has a bylaw, and you could think of different ways you might combine the benefits of each. Okay. Yeah. So could we start with the external, then the contract co solution, and help us understand kind of why you consider this, what you guys currently are thinking in terms of advantages, disadvantages.
Sure. Well, this is Greg. I'll jump in. I think that the first off, in terms of how the contract co solution kind of came to be, as I said, this really grew directly out of our two-day face-to-face in Frankfurt. I think it was in November. When we broke down the major functions that we saw NTIA as performing, and putting aside the authorization validation function for a moment, we tried to fulfill those major functions through a structure where those functions were assigned to groups. And one of the feelings was that if a single group performed all of these functions, that that would kind of be a too great a concentration of power, and while that might not create a second ICANN, that it would create an entity that would essentially have kind of too much
power structure into it. So that was the idea of creating kind of a virtually a shell as Contract Co., and having the MRT, in essence, instruct Contract Co. And for there to be a contract, there needs to be an entity that can legally hold a contract, or legally enter into a contract. So therefore, Contract Co. needed to exist, but the MRT couldn't be a contracting party, but that it needed to functionally be the party that had the powers of the contract delegated to it, and that further the idea was that the CSC would be a smaller, more nimble, more customer focused body to perform those kind of day to day functions. And that the MRT, which at one point was called the Periodic Review Team, but then we realized it would normally be conducting periodic reviews, would have the kind of more the second level powers plus the kind of the power of the contract, including the power to make a determination of material breach and issue a notice of breach and all that sort of thing. So the idea was to kind of try to match the structures to the function that we identified. And that was what came out of Frankfurt as really our only fleshed-out proposal at that time. And all the rest of the proposals were involved. Yeah. So
sorry,
the other proposals.
Matt,
yes. Oh, yeah, please come in.
Yes. What I wanted to add, because one of the whole idea, I think, behind Contract Co. was a good one, and that was keeping simple. There's a contractual entity now that oversees a DIANA function. It's the NTIA. So let's keep a contractual party there, and that had to then to be Contract Co. So the main driver was to make things simple, but didn't work out quite well. But the idea was it.
Okay. And have you talked about the MRT? Because I had, Jonathan, you made reference to this as an analogy, and I had kind of made a note to myself in reading this. Would the MRT be the board of this if there were a Contract Co.? Literally be the board.
I think there's been a number of discussions, I think, about what the relationship of MRT would be to Contract Co., and one of the options would be for it to be the actual board of Contract Co. And I think one of the criticisms, if you will, of the draft proposal that came out of Frankfurt was that there wasn't all kind of detail on every level. That while it was both complex, it wasn't detailed enough, which is an interesting thing to pull off, having both too much detail and too little all at the same time. But in any case, by and large, my feeling is that it wouldn't be best for it to be the board. But this is where we kind of put ourselves in to some extent in your hands. I would not do if I were sitting in a law firm doing a transaction. I wouldn't make massive structuring decisions all by myself. So we're looking for counsel on what that relationship could be and what the pros and cons of different relationships would be. But I think by and large, the thought was that the board of Contract Co. would not be MRT, but would be some sort of small, constrained, boring board. And that overall Contract Co. would be highly constrained and narrowed by its bylaws and articles, that it would be kind of a special purpose vehicle almost. That it would have structural, it would have significant limitations on what it could do.
Greg?
By analogy, yes.
So Greg, this is Holly. Could you give us a little bit more insights into thinking, in your thinking on that? Because, frankly, a board well constructed can be a significant accountability mechanism and, could take on the MRT kinds of functions. We just interested in how much effort was thought was given to that, or is that sort of just a sort of an assumption that the board doesn't provide a mechanism that would be appropriate here?
Greg and Holly, if I could just make a comment at that point. I mean, I think that's a really good. As we left Frankfurt, Greg is absolutely correct. It was envisaged that we would have we would fulfill the board function with whatever was necessary, but the board would necessarily be light, and the so-called periodic review team at the time, or later the multi-stakeholder review team, MRT, would in principle be able to give directions to the board. At a later point, I remember when it was, it sort of struck me in the same way it appears to strike you that, that there were certainly analogies, which is why I made the analogy, and I've got to be careful because it's very much my analogy rather than something that's come out of the group. But it struck me, having, you know, with my own personal experience of corporate governance, is that in essence there were some analogies behind a structure whereby, as you say, a well-constructed board might appropriately represent different components of what was required. And it may have been overcomplicated to have both a separate board for Contract Co. and a multi-stakeholder review team potentially directing that board. So that's just my two cents worth, Greg. I don't know if that covers it accurately, but that's certainly my response to Holly's question.
Thanks.
What we're looking for is some insights into why that path seems more interesting or more fruitful to the CWG to date, rather than saying, I mean, there are lots of different paths, clearly, but you could conceive sort of a fairly straightforward situation in which the multi-stakeholders have a role in selecting the board of this contract company. The board could actually be representatives of some of the stakeholders, although I'm sure some of the concern is capture. And then you would give some of the functions that you might otherwise have to that reviewing body to that board.
This is Greg.
Greg, sorry, just one other response to that, and that touches on the concept of the concern over the mini ICANN, because if, as you start to go down that route, you see that it has that structurally that has analogies with ICANN, where part of the stakeholder community are responsible for selecting board members on the current ICANN board. So I just thought I'd give that reason why that perspective comes at that point. Over to you, Greg.
I was just going to say that I think that some of the concerns that led to the separations that ended up were that if the MRT were the board of the Contract Co., there were two levels of issue. Practically speaking, that might not be enough oversight over the board at that point. And I think the idea was that while the Contract Co. board would be lightweight, that it would have the power to tell the MRT that it was giving Contract Co. an instruction that was outside of Contract Co.'s limited remit, so that if the MRT were captured, so to speak, that the Contract Co. board could say, no, you can't take the route and move it to Russia, or some other such hypothetical. And so that there would be, while it would be limited, it would have power, and in essence would be a check and balance against the MRT, and that if you were to combine the MRT and Contract Co., that you kind of create an entity that needs, you know, further oversight. And obviously, you can take oversight down the whole hall of mirrors forever, but put that aside.
But I guess what I'm struggling with, Greg, is how do you then assure that you don't have the same issues with the MRT? I mean, it's sort of where does the levels of oversight stop? How do we ensure that the MRT then doesn't have the possibly run afoul of the same kinds of things that that the board could run afoul of?
Right. Well, I think the idea was that the board would act as a check and balance on the MRT. If the MRT were not itself the board,
there's a separate issue, which is that the MRT would have, you know, representatives of various stakeholder groups and organizations. But remember that, you know, virtually all of these people are either volunteers or they're serving on behalf of their employers or on behalf of their government, such as the GAC members. And so, for instance, if, you know, the representative of Norway were on the MRT, there was the question of how could the representative of Norway be a board member, or Norway itself be a board member of Contract Co., and that was a concern, too. By and large, in the ICANN community, everyone feels comfortable serving on things like the CWG in whatever capacity they kind of come to ICANN. But
right.
The idea of serving on a corporate board seemed like a bridge too far.
For some of the members of the stakeholder community.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand.
Indeed, I think that's
so
why you don't...
Let me just add one other point. And
go ahead, now.
Thanks, Craig. I would just add another one other point. And I think these questions are both useful and important, and they highlight your ability to interrogate our thinking, possibly more importantly, the motivation for our thinking. And my understanding of what we were seeking to achieve with you, Sidley, was A, that interrogation, and B, potentially alternatives, and said, well, now we understand your motivation, which is kind of where you're very tentatively starting to go at this point. And I think that's my expectation of what expert advice might give us, is that you might challenge our thinking entirely and say, ah, now we understand what you were trying to achieve. Why on earth didn't you think of structuring it like this? Now, clearly it's premature to have that conversation now, but in essence, I just wanted to capture that, you know, that expectation ultimately,
mm-hmm.
that it's not necessarily about achieving what we wanted to. It's about challenging what we were even trying, the structures we were, as amateurs, playing with.
I think we're on the same page around what the goal is here, which is in providing advice and helping you think through the potentials and the issues you've put on the table, to also, you know, help make sure that there aren't other things should be in your toolkit to think about, and to help provide some advice that you can then use to shape either these proposals or potentially other proposals.
This is Greg. I'd just like to pick up on what Jonathan said, because while we don't necessarily have to return to that immediately afterwards, I think that's a critical point and comes to the nub of things. I was kind of struck as you were asking these questions, which are, you know, excellent and perfectly appropriate questions, that Jonathan and I and others who've kind of been coordinating this group at various levels have been answering those questions or variations of them to various different bodies for months, and that I, as kind of, say, the U.S. lawyer in the room, and virtually the only U.S. practicing lawyer in the entire CWG, although there are some who are kind of participants, none of them are really kind of, you know, embroiled as I am. So we've been answering these questions within the CWG, and then on webinars, and on panels, and then ultimately we come to the point where I can't satisfy anybody, and everyone just, it kind of, that gets to where the logjam of where we're at,
mm-hmm.
which is that there's only so far that we can go as, you know, in essence, an amateur group, and I'm not going to hold myself out, you know, as, you know, this is not my core competency. I've worked on hundreds of transactions, but usually as the IP tech guy on the transaction. I'm not a first chair corporate M&A partner or, you know, corporate governance partner. So there's only so far we could all go, plus everyone, you know, by being an interested party, I can't provide disinterested advice. So we kind of came to the end of the road in answering these questions. You know, and the answers may be, you know, suitable, they may be unsuitable. There are, you know, all the alternatives may be workable. There may be pros and cons in each of them. But in the end, we came to a log jam or a Gordian knot or a series of Gordian knots on these different proposals and what we're trying to accomplish. And everyone basically said, we just can't go further without independent legal advice. We don't know, you know, those of us who don't know enough to really evaluate these need the independent legal advice, and those who are trying to provide legal input, you know, can't go further without either, you know, validation or correction or new ideas from independent legal advice. And that's why we're here.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask the team if we have more questions at this point on the contract proposal, or whether we should talk a little bit more, turn to the sort of the notion of some kind of external trust.
Yeah, Holly, I'm ready to move on to the external trust.
Okay. So let's talk about the external trust. Sharon, do you have specific questions?
Just
do we want to hear
more of a general question about how that came about, what people thought the advantages of that would be.
I guess first I would say this is the last entrant. And literally made it into this document probably on the final draft before it went out to the law firm. And it kind of came out of a need for an external alternative to the contract co. The two internal models developed kind of in the meantime, and we had put together what we called the RFP 3B group, which was intended to explore and flesh out, to some extent, to the extent you see it, internal models. Because the groups like the ALAC that were trying to cook it up on their own could get only so far without, you know, working within the structure of and the support of the CWG. So this came from essentially one participant in the group who proposed this model, and then it was, you know, debated a bit in the CWG, and then placed here. And in part, I think it was a reaction to kind of the negative reactions of a, you know, substantial sector to the idea of contract co and the complexities that were seen in the so-called contract co solution.
Got it. Okay, well, that's
but at the same time, the need for, you know, that was perceived, at least by some, for an external solution.
Okay, that's very helpful, because it's not an immediate, obvious choice, so we were somewhat puzzled about it, but that's helpful to understand. It was a late entrant and really just trying to create some alternative to the contract co. So that's, I think, all we need to really understand on
that. May I ask a question about primary purpose and duty of the trust in this document is described as selecting and contracting. So having the IANA functions operator, so having a very, very similar purpose really and function to contract co. Any thought given to it having a lesser role, which would be simply to be the body that would determine whether whether ICANN was performing the IANA functions appropriately in what would otherwise be mostly an internal solution, and have the right to, in that oversight role, to come in and seek change in the unusual circumstance that change was called for?
Mm.
So essentially, sort of have the... I almost want to call it like the golden share, right? The notion that a trust established simply for a point at which there's a determination, you know, that you know, or a sense by the multi-stakeholder bodies that this really isn't working, and an ability for multi-stakeholders to go to the trust and say, okay, it's time for you to consider exercising this power.
I think that's a perceptive question. I've heard something I think similar to that. I hope I'm reflecting this accurately, but whereby either the trust or a multi-stakeholder review team could be convened to execute such an act. So in that context, one might have a form of dormant trust, or, you know, the trust is the vehicle that is pre-prepared in the event of such a requirement being needed. So I hope that's an adequate response, but that's I think that elements around that have been discussed along those lines.
Okay.
But I would agree with that, and I don't think that's even necessarily excluded by what's in the legal scoping document. And I think that in looking at this, I think the idea that of the MRT and CSC performing their functions was kind of assumed as part of this proposal, and not that the Board of Trustees would take on those kind of functions of kind of operational, you know, oversight under the contract, that even though it was the contracting party, so to speak, that it would not be the one exercising those day-to-day or month-to-month roles, but only exercise roles at extreme times.
Yeah, well, I was almost thinking you're taking out of the selecting and contracting aspect of this and only having sort of the ability to take it away and give it someplace else in the extreme situation. Okay, so I think we could probably, if no one else has questions, move on to, and I take it that hasn't been taken off the table, it just wasn't put on the table, correct?
Correct.
Okay, why don't we move to the internal solution? Unless other people have questions about the trust proposed.
Very briefly to that point, that's a really good point, because I think in many ways nothing is off the table, and that's part of the advice we seek. So just to be clear about that, to the extent that it isn't currently proposed, that may be because of the limit of our collective imagination or knowledge rather than the fact that it's been proposed and discounted.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
And I would also just add to that, you know, we're one of the things we're looking for you guys to do is to put things on the table, take things off the table, say that, you know, this is not quite what should be on the table, but really this is, you know, we would change these things, and now it's kind of fit for being on the table.
Okay. So any other questions, or should we move on to the internal solution? So there are two variations of this, as I understand. And one is where simply the IANA functions contracting ability sort of goes away, and you just give ICANN the right to be, you know, to ICANN becomes the IANA functions operator. And you have your MRT and CSC structures as in the other function, but you want some method to make sure that you'd have separability if you had to. Is that the thought? So that's why I raised that other kind of trust, external trust issue, is perhaps relating to this kind of an internal, you know, solution where you have a hybrid.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
And whether you do that through a bylaw that can't be changed or something else, when we talk about bylaws that can't be changed, you know, I think we're really talking about some kind of function that's either really not a bylaw but an articles provision, and then the question becomes, under California law, is that something that you have to go get approval from the state for? I don't know the answer right now, but or whether you need some kind of, you know, this might contemplate the notion of a membership body. There are a whole lot of variations that I can sort of think of. Has there been any discussion of those kinds of considerations?
I would say that there have been discussions, but again, kind of haven't taken them far enough down the road.
Okay.
Jonathan Martin, have anything to add on that?
Martin here. What I understand is that there have been discussions around this theme in the CCWG, so the accountability group, is it's quite related struggle with. But I've heard from them that they also think about membership structures and things like that. But mm-hmm. I don't have the details.
So one of the reasons I asked the question is because in our conversation yesterday with the CCWG, they were talking to us about the potential of a joint representation. One of the issues they wanted to know was whether we had experience taking a not-for-profit that is a non-membership organization into a membership structure. That's why I just raised it. So I know the issue is bubbling around in other circles. Sharon, do you have any questions about the internal solution, either variation?
No.
I find complexity in the second variation. I'm trying to understand what really is contemplated by it. But Sharon, if you have questions, please jump in.
No questions on the golden bylaw approach. Maybe we can move on to the trust approach. So, same question. Can you give us a little bit of background about how this structure came about, why it was proposed, what people perceived to be the advantages?
Well, I think that this structure, came out of, or was primarily proposed by a group coming out of the Australian CCPLD manager, AUDA, and to some extent in examining it myself, not being a trust lawyer, but seems, to some part be inspired by things that exist in Australian trust law that aren't necessarily existing in U.S. trust law, such as the ability, whether a trust is an entity that can contract, what kind of entity a trust is, or non-entity. And so this was proposed kind of well after Frankfurt, as we were kind of realized that we've kind of gone as far as we could in discussing external solutions, and to some extent, slightly later, the Golden Bylaw solution came out of, initially kind of off, out of the CWG groups, then coming and bringing things into as I mentioned, the RFP3B subgroup, named because the third section of the RFP is the heart of the proposal. In other words, what will things look like afterwards? So we first started a group called RFP3, which was examining kind of and trying to flesh out the major proposal, the contract co-proposal, and then RFP3B was kind of the skunk works or lab for different thinking that wasn't revolving around the existing proposal at all. This was really kind of brought in and proposed. One of AUDA's senior execs, who actually hadn't been participating all that much in the CWG, came in and kind of explained it, a guy named Paul Schindler, and it was being championed by, I'm not sure if he's the head of AUDA, but the senior person in AUDA, Chris Despain, who also is a member of the ICANT board, but he took pains to say that this was not a board position that he was taking in any stretch of the imagination. So this was kind of, came out of those discussions, and again, looking for, and I think this may have been to some extent inspired by either their own structure or by structures that they were familiar with in Australian entities that they had familiarity with.
Okay.
Maybe I can add something. So it's Martin. What I understand is that the Golden Bylaw proposal was also supported by AUDA, and that they had been looking into it, and if such a thing would work under Californian law, and that they got signals that that would be difficult, and then they came up with this quite difficult to understand, for me at least, proposal with trust. So, but I think I remember that Paul Schindler, who brought this up, even said that they, if the Golden Bylaw would be possible in any form, they thought that would be a better idea. So maybe we can, I'm not sure if we can do that, but it shouldn't be your primarily our focus on this one, I think.
Just to be clear for me, because the MRT is something that does seem to have, there's a lot of importance vested in this sort of multi-regional review or multi-regional body, board, entity, whatever, that can have some oversight. But the oversight that it is directed to is to, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I read this, and I want to be sure, is the oversight of the MRT directed to whether or not the INA functions operator, in this case ICANN, is satisfactorily performing the INA functions, as opposed to, it's not a policy-making or policy-review board that if they feel that the policies that are being adapted by ICANN or being put out by ICANN on the policy as the policy entity, if those things, if the MRT disagrees with those policies, would the MRT have the ability to pull back the INA functions contract from ICANN and award it to somebody else? Because I'm a little worried about checks and balances where we've got this MRT board that sort of hangs out there on the side, or MRT entity that hangs out there on the side, and yet people are contemplating giving it the power to dictate and authorize changes. And to me, that there's a capture problem there, because I see limited oversight on the MRT if it's not kind of brought out into the sunlight.
I think there are a couple of points on that. First, I think it's important that the MRT's power, or any power, to make drastic changes be clearly defined, as it would be in kind of termination and escalation provisions in an agreement, or maybe even more clearly and extensively defined than that. And I think specifically, one of the difficult issues is whether there is the right to kind of pull the IANA functions from ICANN based on problems not with IANA, but with ICANN on an enterprise level, and whether those powers should even exist, and if so, how they could be defined and managed. And I think that one of the issues in terms of MRT oversight, and I agree that, that obviously there are capture issues, is that the MRT, by being a multi-stakeholder body, would have, representatives from kind of every stakeholder group, non-commercial, commercial, private sector, registries, registrars, at large, government advisory, security and stability advisory committee, or council, et cetera. So you kind of would have to have a kind of almost a some sort of Manchurian candidate kind of takeover to have groups that have such disparate interests all have their representatives move to take a drastic action. And I think that, again, one of the thoughts was that these people would be very much representative, and that if the groups that put them in place, for instance, if the commercial stakeholder group's representative was acting in a way that the commercial stakeholder group thought was inappropriate, that they could be pulled. Unlike, not to wade into other waters, but unlike a board member who may have been selected by a still stakeholder group, but once on the board has responsibilities that aren't directly representative of the group that put them there.
Yeah, but you could have a representative board, not a expertise board, but that's a detail. I think we're up on some time limitations, so I know various silly people have some other calls. Holly, how do you want to handle next steps?
I think Holly.
Hi. No, I'm still here on the.
Oh, great. So Holly,
I was asking you how you wanted to sort of handle next steps since we're at the end of our 2 hours. I think we've lost Holly. Sharon, do you think that we didn't get into some of the 12 questions and sub-questions that were supplied by the participants?
Yeah, I think that's okay. I think that's more on the level of detail. I mean, it was, Jonathan, you hit the nail on the head in terms of our goal, which is to, we asked a lot of questions, and thank you for your patience with us in giving us all this background, but it really helps. It will help us consider the structures you have, consider whether there are structures that aren't on the list that maybe should be considered, and hopefully will lead to, better set of recommendations coming from us. So thanks for your time on that.
Great. Well, thank you all. I mean, I hope this is going to be recorded and will be heard. I hope that the group thinks we've represented their ideas accurately, and it does sound like it's been useful to you. So, great.
I'd like to thank you as well, Greg. I guess I would just say that in terms of the 12 questions, that is what we have been discussing, actually having answered in kind of an FAQ fashion, at least in time for Istanbul. So certainly we would want you to ask us questions for clarification and to understand where those came from. But to some people, at least, a key portion of the legal advice, so to speak, is in essence getting answers to those questions, because those questions kind of bubbled up from all the participants in terms of, and came from their ability or inability to kind of judge where each of these four models or the components of the models came from and how applicable they could be and what their pros and cons were. So that's kind of, in terms of next steps, something very much to discuss.
Okay. I think that the Sidley folks need to take some of this offline and process through this, and we've had some notes as well. And we can circle back and see if we want to schedule a further call to go through some of these questions and ask some questions or ask for some clarification on these things. Because I know that we had talked about, or in the remit to us, had talked about, not expecting, responses to each specific question, but maybe we think about how to sort of organize some responses to the categories generally, or to, salient ones. Some of them are kind of redundant or appear in multiple places. But I think the next step would be for us to circle back on that point in specific and come back to you with a request for some follow-up discussion or perhaps some written request for clarification as well.
Absolutely. I think one of the things we're trying to schedule is a regularly scheduled time for a call between the client committee and Sidley, and we've been looking at Friday. The Friday time is rather late for Europe, and I think Martin is having some, at least one, if not more, of the members we know is going to have problems with that, given the six-hour time difference between the East Coast and Europe, other than UK, Portugal.
And 9 hours for those of us on the West Coast.
Right, right. So essentially, there's never a good time. It's just a question of what's the least bad time. Obviously, there's no 8-hour day in which a 9-hour difference can be made part of the traditional 8-hour workday. None of us actually work. But I think that if we look toward Thursday or Friday, or at least this Friday, for a follow-up call, that would be something, a time for next discussions, as well as taking things on to the client list for follow-up.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll circle up with Holly internally, and we'll get back to you with some ideas. But in the meanwhile, if you let us know whether there's availability for Friday, hopefully not quite so early for the West Coast, but something that's a little bit tolerable for both sides. Both ends of the extreme, I should say. All right. Thank you all very much for your time.
Yep, thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.